Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's press conference where he publicly staked out his position in the ongoing negotiations as the Republican-generated debt ceiling crisis looms. Economist James Galbraith joins us to assess what the President has already put on the table in terms of cutting programs considered Democratic sacred cows and what compromise he is likely to get in return from the apparently uncompromising congressional Republicans. Then we will go to London to speak with veteran Fleet Street reporter Philip Knightley about the burgeoning scandal that is being called Rupert Murdoch's Watergate, following the latest revelation by the BBC that Murdoch's minions were digging up dirt on former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, presumably to threaten or blackmail him. We'll look into divisions within the Murdoch media empire and how much public outrage might embolden politicians to lose their fear of the political kingmaker who can either make or break their careers. Then finally, veteran Los Angeles Times investigative reporter William C. Rempel joins us in the studio to talk about his new book, At the Devil's Table, The Untold Story of the Insider Who Brought Down the Cali Cartel. With Guatemala already a narco state and Mexico fighting a war against narco terrorists, we will discuss the extraordinary financial and political power drug cartels wield and how their malignant grip on a country was broken by one man. I'm now joined by James Galbraith, who is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Good to be back with you.
And it would seem that today, to some extent, President Obama may have turned the tables in the sense that the Republicans have been painting him into a corner, or perhaps they've been painting themselves into a corner on this debt crisis. How much do you think there is leverage in the threat that he issued today that he will not sign a 30-day or a 60-day or a 90-day extension, that he would veto such a bill?
Well, I think that was a shrewd and sensible move because nobody wants to go through this on a continuing basis. So what he simply did was to say that he would only accept a deal that raises the debt ceiling by enough to get us well past the 2012 elections. And that, I think, is quite reasonable. Then the question is, what kind of deal can we possibly imagine that would be acceptable to all parties? And I think the facts of the matter there are that the president has already offered vast concessions, vast cuts in programs that should not be cut for this purpose, while getting essentially so far nothing in return. The Republicans are basically saying they will not be party to anything that so much as caresses a hair on the head of any of their wealthy backers.
So, who they now call job creators.
Yes, the wealthy job creators. Yes, that's what we're talking about for sure.
So, but obviously, it's puzzling to understand why the president has allowed himself to either drink the Republican Kool-Aid or at least accept their narrative in tying the economy to the debt crisis, which was entirely generated by the Republicans themselves.
Well, the debt crisis was generated. I mean, the debt crisis. First of all, there is no debt crisis.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
The debt ceiling is is being reached. It needs to be raised. It has been raised many, many times since it was first enacted in 1917. It's a bad faith piece of legislation to begin with. It always was a kind of thing that was there to reassure the rubes back home that you were being responsible when in fact you were doing what was necessary and issuing bonds to cover public deficits. But that aside, there is no crisis here. The federal government is not in danger of defaulting. It is not paying. It's paying an extremely low interest rate, even on very long-term bonds. It has no. It is not going to become Greece and cannot become Greece. So the whole question of a crisis is a simple artifact of the expiration date or the date at which the Treasury reaches the current statutory debt limit. Nothing else.
Well, in an environment, James Galbraith, where I think you could fairly make the argument that the Republicans prosper from a bad economy, and Democrats will suffer because of a bad economy, who would win in this case of calling the other's bluff? If the president vetoes, if they make one of these offers of these temporary fixes, and he vetoes it, and then we pass the August 2nd deadline, if the economy goes into the kind of tailspin that it will, and the global economic structures will be shaken to their roots, that'll just make the economy worse and make the Obama and the Democrats' elections prospects in 2012 even worse than they are now.
This kind of interaction between politics and economics is, I'm afraid to say, far over my pay grade. The problem that I have is that completely lost in this discussion is the need to do something with the condition of the economy that it is that we have now, where we have 9% unemployment, we have a continuing crisis of foreclosures, falling property values, a whole host of serious problems, and a slowing growth rate, plainly visible in the current data, completely without this, complication of the debt ceiling debate. But what we're getting out of the debt ceiling debate is a set of concessions from the White House already on the table that will, over a very long period of time, make things markedly worse for millions of working Americans as they get older and they need Social Security and Medicare. If we get, for example, a change in the way in which Social Security cost of living adjustments are made over the long term, what that means is that the oldest and the poorest of retirees will suffer the most. That is not a concession, I think, that any reasonable person would make to anybody, even if it were something that was required to get past this particular hurdle. It is taking leading with or conceding the interests of your most vulnerable people and people who have worked all their lives on the assumption that this very modest body of protection, Social Security and Medicare, would be there for them when they are elderly and can no longer support themselves. So I'm saying that this is it is not constructive for the economy to do this, and it is in many ways a dreadful statement about the current state of the leadership of the Democratic Party that Democrats are being asked to make those concessions.
Again, I'm speaking with James Galbraith, Professor of Economics at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of The Predator State. Now, of course, Social Security, there is a Social Security fix, not the one that apparently has been offered on
Social
the table.
Social Security doesn't need to be fixed.
Well, no, in the sense that Senator Sanders and others say if the wealthy paid a little bit more, then any possibility of a long-term problem with Social
Security. I have a great deal of respect for Senator Sanders. I know what he's driving at. But the reality is that if you left Social Security alone with the existing commitments and the existing tax rates, the world would go on just fine. The interest rate will not be one iota higher as a result of doing that than as a result of raising the payroll tax on wealthy people in order to have more revenue coming into the federal fisc. I mean, the two problems are totally disconnected from each other. And
right.
So I think it is a mistake to say that there is this alternative Social Security fix. Social Security does not need to be fixed. It should be left alone.
Well, I was going on to say, though, that we're heading in the opposite direction in the sense that, as for what we know about the compromises that John Boehner offered up and then reneged on, was that they would allow the tax cuts for the wealthy to expire. But apparently that's only going to bring in $800 billion to $1 trillion of the $4 trillion that's being put on the table. So that looks like the Democrats are giving up 3-1, doesn't it?
Well, the Democrats are giving up on the spending side something over 80% of the total package. So this is a concession, which is a prospective deal, which has already been heavily weighted toward what the Republicans claim to want. Whether the Republicans actually do want this or not, I think, is an open question, because obviously they got up and walked away saying, no, they didn't, 83% wasn't good enough. They wanted 100%, which is something that they're not going to get. So, you know, what their deeper motivations are, and I say bless them for walking away from the deal, because I don't want to offer them the 83%. And I say, recoup that, take that back from the table, say that was once off, and now we're going to have to deal on some entirely different basis. The right way to resolve this issue is for Congress to face up to its responsibility and pass a clean increase in the debt ceiling, period, end of story. A clean, substantial, long-term increase in the debt ceiling. That is the right way to deal with this. This is a totally artificial crisis. It's being ginned up for political purposes. And in doing that, the Republicans in Congress are acting in plain violation of the very clear language of the Constitution of the United States. They're doing something which the authors of the Constitution, 14th Amendment, Section 4, foresaw would be extraordinarily destructive to the ongoing government of the United States if people were allowed to get away with it. That's the problem. It is, in some sense, what we're seeing here is an extra constitutional attack on the government of the United States, and a president who is not facing up to the reality that that's what he's up against.
Well, it feels like extortion within blackmail, within a great deal of chutzpah. I mean, just to be realistic for a moment, as you've pointed out, the debt ceiling is a phony crisis generated by the Republicans. Nobody, by the way, on the Democratic side appears to want to invoke that section of the 14th Amendment, but it's there in plain English. But if the Republicans really cared about the debt, how come the last three Republican presidents, Bush Jr. and Senior, and President Reagan, ran up over half of the entire debt in the entire life of the Republic, and George Bush in 8 years, one third of the entire debt? I mean, you could actually make a different argument. It's actually that the Republicans are the one who not only put us in debt, but want to put us in debt. They're the ones who want to break the federal government.
Well, creating a national debt is not the same thing as breaking the federal government. The federal government needs to create debt for certain purposes. It will create debt in any event when it's faced with a severe economic downturn because tax revenues fall. And to say a nice word about George W. Bush, which doesn't happen to me often, on the one hand, he came into office in a recession that he did not create. That certainly created debt. And later on, at the end of his term, the financial crisis, which he has a great deal of responsibility for, forced the creation of a lot more debt. These things happen, but the debt itself is not the cause of a crisis in the life of the Republic. The crisis in the life of the Republic is the unemployment rate that we face now, the foreclosures that we face now, the fact that the middle class in the United States is losing its hard-won financial wealth as the value of its housing falls to less than what they owe on it. These are the problems that we face. In addition to that, we have an energy problem, we have a climate problem, we have all kinds of issues that we should be dealing with. We have a decayed infrastructure that we should be rebuilding. The debt crisis, the so-called debt crisis, is a pure distraction from this, ginned up as a kind of, as I say, constitutional or extra-constitutional coup d'etat. And the president needs to face that reality. He's in a tough position. But the Democrats, when you say they will not invoke the Constitution, they are in complete dereliction of their responsibilities. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land.
Well, but the part of it that's so puzzling is how the Democrats have already lost the narrative, how they've allowed the state of the economy to be linked to the debt when it's a phony debt crisis. And the reality is that the economy is getting worse, the recovery stalled. Job creation is what we should be talking about. We don't have a deficit crisis. We have a revenue crisis, and everything would be solved with people going back to work. And now we learn that close to $2 in every $10 that goes into Americans' pockets come from federal payments, from unemployment, food stamps, Social Security, disability, etc. And that about $37 billion of this money is going to be drained from the nation's pocketbooks this year, making the problem even deeper. So we're actually heading in a direction where the recovery is getting stalled and throttled, and yet we're having this ridiculous...
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. What's happening here and what is being proposed is to cut back on those sources of income which are helping ordinary Americans to make ends meet. And in addition to that, the federal government, the total government, federal, state, and local governments, have lost about 500,000 public employees since President Obama took office at the beginning of 2009. And that's not his fault. That's what was inflicted on states and localities, mainly, by their revenue crises. But the notion that the economy is better off because those 500,000 teachers and librarians and fire and police and so forth are not working, whereas they were, It's bizarre.
Well, what we don't really know exactly what's been offered. There's an indication that maybe one of the concessions was on Medicare to raise the threshold from 65 to 67 when it kicks in. We don't know exactly what went on in Vice President Biden's negotiations, but we understand that there were cuts offered in farm subsidies, student aid, federal workers' pensions, and domestic agency budgets, but that Eric Cantor walked out because he didn't want tax cuts, tax breaks for oil and gas companies, and deductions for the wealthy at cut, and he resisted the Democrats' efforts to cut the Pentagon. So... That looks equally lopsided. That the Biden plan as
well. I think the game of offering cuts in vital public services and protections, which have no economic policy purpose, no purpose is served by raising the age on Medicare, except that you will have more medically bankrupt people between the ages of 65 and 67, which are ages when many people are vulnerable to sicknesses that they can't afford to pay for the treatment for. That's what Medicare is there for, to protect them from that. So why are we transferring to those people the cost of this particular political negotiation? It makes no sense to me. I would stand firmly in defense of those people, recognizing that there's nothing lost by doing it. It's not as though the interest rate is going to be any lower than it presently is if you make that concession than if you don't. The two things are just, from an economic standpoint, totally disconnected from each other.
So, just in closing, Professor Galbraith, do you think that, I hear you say that the president should take advantage of the Republicans' uncompromising attitude, but he's already given up so much. It doesn't look like it would be great if he would take all that stuff off the table, but
I think the president is engaged in a political game to make himself look reasonable, to make the other side look unreasonable, to make himself look like the more serious deficit hawk, to make the other side look like they're not serious. These are political games that he may or may not win. That's his objective, not mine, and not, I think, the objective of the larger public. If the essential social programs of the United States that have been in place since the New Deal of the Great Society, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, are compromised in this process, if crucial government functions, transportation funding and all the rest, are cut completely needlessly as a result of this. And if the Constitution of the United States goes down the drain as a result of this, opening us up to an endless series of blackmail negotiations over the future, then I say history will not look favorably upon the presidency of Barack Obama, irrespective of whether he wins this political game or not, which he may well do.
Yeah, but in the short term, if all of those things are done, the recovery will be even more remote and less likely.
Oh,
and
that's true, too. Yeah, no, that's true.
I mean, we're talking about...
From an economic standpoint, sure.
Yeah, I mean, but that's his immediate political survival.
But I think to be fair on that, you know, if you're cutting Social Security 25 and 30 years from now, this is not going to have much effect on the economy right now. I mean, we're not talking there. We're just doing something that we should not be doing, that we do not need to do, and for which there is no benefit, except, as I say, these possible political optics that everybody seems to be so concerned with.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that politics overwhelmed economics in this discussion, but that's what we're facing.
It is, indeed.
Thank you for joining us, James Galbraith.
As always. Pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with James Galbraith, who's professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll go to London to talk with a Fleet Street veteran.
I still owe money to the money, to the money I owe. I never thought about love when I thought about home. I still owe money to the money, to the money I owe. The floors are falling out from everybody I know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Philip Knightley, who was a special correspondent for the Sunday Times for 20 years and one of the leaders of its inside investigative team. He was twice named Journalist of the Year in the British Press Awards and won the Overseas Press Club of America Award for his first book on foreign affairs, The First Casualty, about war reporting. And, of course, he wrote his biography, A Hack's Progress. And thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing, Philip Knightley. From
London.
And there you are in the center of the storm in London, where I believe there's a piece by Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame suggesting that the News of the World scandal has become Rupert Murdoch's Watergate.
Yes, I don't think that's an exaggeration. It's going to run and run and run. We've not had the worst of it yet. Even Rebecca Brooks says there's a lot more to come. Very damaging, maybe. She told the staff of the News of the World when she farewelled them that it would take 12 months for it all to come out, and then they would understand her position better. The newspapers and the commentators are all both saying that there's a lot more to come, and they would not be surprised if some of the leading participants in this scandal end up in jail.
But is this like Watergate, a situation where the cover-up is worse than the crime?
I think it is. I mean, the News of the World did its utmost possible to keep the payments to corrupt cops secret. It tried to insist that it was only one rogue reporter who was doing this hacking. And in an attempt to cover it up, I mean, they've suddenly found that it all comes crashing down on their heads.
Well, it does seem that the family are involved. I don't know the extent to which Murdoch knew about this activity or whether, like Nixon, he tried to keep his distance, if I can belabor the Watergate analogy. James Murdoch, his son, seems to be in the crosshairs. How do you think, Philip Knightley, this will eventually reach Murdoch himself?
I don't think it will reach Murdoch. I mean, I don't think he's distanced himself from it. He claims that he knew nothing about it, although some of his staff say that he kept such a close eye on expenditure that he could not possibly have not known that this money was being expended on private detectives. But I don't know. I don't think that it will extend to Murdoch, but I think that if I was James, I would be very worried at the moment, because he has agreed that he signed off on to some of the money paid out in compensation of these wronged people, and that is virtually an admission that the hacking had taken place. And if he signed off on payments, then he's certainly at risk.
Again, I'm speaking with Philip Knightley, who is a veteran Fleet Street reporter in London. He was a special correspondent for the Sunday Times for 20 years and one of the leaders of its inside investigative team, and has won numerous awards, including the Overseas Press Club of America Award for his first book about war correspondents, The First Casualty. He also wrote an autobiography about his own journalism, A Hack's Progress, and we're talking about the unfolding scandal of the News of the World, which News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's company, were forced to close. There's some doubt as to whether they'll rebrand it and reopen it. But at the moment, the full scope of the scandal, of course, outraged everybody in England, including the Prime Minister, who himself is implicated, I guess, in as much as his PR guy has been indicted. But for the benefit of the audience, the Murdoch journalist hacked into the cell phone of a missing girl. They deleted messages because her box was full. They get giving the poor parents the illusion that the child was still alive, not to mention destroying evidence. I mean, I'm just giving an example of the depravity here. Has it really shocked the country? Because it certainly shocked me.
Yes, it has shocked the country. And the government has received literally hundreds of thousands of complaints from ordinary readers and viewers. The News of the World is being forced to close. And the really dangerous thing is that it's becoming apparent that the News of the World was not the only paper that was engaged in these practices. And that suggests a level of corruption among the police force and among journalists themselves that is deplorable.
So what's the political fallout? Because my understanding is that Murdoch has essentially been able to intimidate and blackmail British politicians. He's almost a kingmaker if he decided to anoint Tony Blair and more recently Cameron. And they've all had to pay fealty to him in order to get ahead in their political careers. Where does that stand?
Well, somebody made the comment recently that there has been a secret cabinet minister, cabinet member, in every recent British government, namely Rupert Murdoch, and that his support was so assiduously sought after that he was the kingmaker in every government in recent times. Parliamentarians paid court to him. And parliamentarians ran scared about the risk of incurring the wrath of Murdoch newspapers, and not only Murdoch newspapers, but other newspapers as well, because they were threatened with being done over, to use a newspaper term, by having their private life peered into in an intrusive, objectionable manner. Everybody has some little secret they would like to keep, and if you're not Lily White, then the Murdoch press would discover what your weakness was by using traditional and untraditional methods of investigation, such as going through your rubbish bins and listening to your telephone calls, discovering your bank accounts, investigating your bank accounts. And that this no parliamentarian would run the risk of having this happen to him by needlessly irritating or investigating or complaining about any newspaper or journalist.
Well, it seems that Phil Knightley, again, veteran Fleet Street reporter in London, we're talking about where the Rupert Murdoch scandal stands now, where apparently the politicians have finally shown some courage and broken, I take it. They're no longer intimidated. Has the worm turned?
Yes, the worm has turned, or is in the process of turning. Mm-hmm. And this will change forever, I think, the relationship between the Parliament and the press. For too long, British political parties have been too close to newspapers. For too long, they've allowed newspapers to sort of set the tone of the relationship with their spin doctors and their fear of rubbing politicians up the wrong way, rubbing newspapers up the wrong way. So now I hope there will be, if there is any reform, some more distant relationship, a more professional relationship, and not one of toadying to the other side.
In terms of Rebecca Brooks, who's in the crosshairs, if you will, of the investigation, she's apparently a practitioner of this kind of blackmail with the politicians. And if you come after me, I'll release all the dirt we have on you. Kind of reminiscent of J. Edgar Hoover's, how he intimidated Washington politicians for so many decades. Why is Murdoch standing by her so assiduously?
Some commentators here have likened the Murdoch clan to a mafia clan. Don't talk to anybody outside the family. Keep all the secrets within the family, and absolute loyalty to any member of the family. I think that it's a bit more than that. I mean, I think that Rupert has found in Rebecca Brooks a sort of surrogate daughter who he's had big plans for, particularly to do with the divisions within the family, the Wendy Deng section, the Murdoch section, and he's been preparing for the time that the, either before his death or after it, that the Murdoch empire has broken up, and he wanted to ensure that the Murdochs within the clan could maintain their dominance against the Deng side, and he was recruiting Rebecca Brooks for the purpose of being a surrogate daughter.
So that means that Murdoch's relatively recent marriage to the younger Chinese woman, Wendy Deng, are you suggesting she's some kind of Trojan horse, that she's managed to split the family and create her own little empire within his empire?
Well, I don't know about a Trojan horse, but she certainly protected her and her children's interests against the wider Murdoch clan.
So that's the breakdown in terms of factions now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in no position to speak with any more authority than anybody else, but that's certainly the viewpoint of Michael Wolff, who was Murdoch's biographer.
Well, I understand that I interviewed Michael Wolff and Murdoch turned on him. And I understand that Michael Wolff himself became the object of this kind of harassment from private detectives, et cetera, that News Corp had employed to intimidate him.
Yes, you don't have to have private detectives. I mean, ordinary journalists will do the job nicely. It's just very, very boring to be under the media spotlight and to be harassed by paparazzi working for Murdoch-controlled press.
How did Michael Wolff get out of the Murdoch crosshairs, do you know?
I think he tried to turn the tables on Murdoch and threatened to release all sorts of material that he'd been holding back from his research into Murdoch. If Murdoch didn't call off, or the Murdoch himself would have to do it, but if the Murdoch press didn't call off their underlings, hirelings, and tough men.
So, Philip Knightley, again, veteran Fleet Street reporter in London. He spent 20 years with the Sunday Times of London, one of the leaders of its Inside investigative team, won twice named Journalist of the Year in Britain and by the British Press Awards, and also won the Overseas Press Club of America Award for his first book on war correspondence, The First Casualties. He also wrote an autobiography, A Hack's Progress, and we're talking about where the unraveling scandal with News Corp in London or in England stands with the closure of the News of the World and revelations of unbelievably callous behaviour on the part of reporters investigating not just the royals, but investigating victims of crimes, as in the case of this young girl that was abducted, which seems to have raised the conscience of the political class, not to mention citizens of the country itself, and put Murdoch and his practices in the spotlight and on the defensive. What's going to happen now about Sky B? Murdoch thought that he could just get the parliament to rubber stamp 90% takeover. Isn't it the world's biggest TV network at this point?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, now there's some possibility he won't be able to move his 40% stake up to 90%. Is that?
It is. It's a distinct possibility. I think that the deal will be delayed and maybe possibly called off because the public now would not stand for Murdoch controlling such a big broadcasting organization. As well as all the newspapers that he does. And the News of the World having dropped out doesn't mean to say that he doesn't own lots of other newspapers, some of whom, incidentally, may well have been involved in exactly the same practices as the News of the World was. We mustn't consider that the News of the World was the only one doing this sort of thing. I never did it in my time on the Sunday Times because apart from having moral objections, the technology wasn't there. I mean, the old-fashioned landline telephone was not open to the abuse that the new cell phones are.
So, given the political heft of Murdoch and how he exercises it, and how he uses his papers, and you were talking earlier about this unholy relationship between the press and politicians, where the press become kingmakers, and the politicians have to basically pay fealty to this press baron, Rupert Murdoch, and I imagine others as well. What we know about Murdoch, which is pretty obvious over here in the United States, is Fox News, how it is so stridently Republican. It is actually almost like a propaganda organ for the government, for the Pravda of the Republican Party, if you will. And he is becoming a kingmaker in terms of the Republican nominees for president. For a while there, about half of them were consultants to Fox News. So what's your understanding? I mean, how does our experience here in the United States differ from your experience there in Great Britain? Is he that overtly political in Britain? Because it seems like he bets all sides. He bets Tony Blair than Cameron.
Much more discreet over here. I mean, because basically the British public and the BBC would not stand for such a partisan broadcaster. That has kept, but largely through the BBC, that has kept Murdoch at bay with sort of Fox News. But we can't be sure that will continue. And Murdoch has a habit of hiring people who worked with people with other organizations that he considered to be his enemies and buying them out. The recent trouble here, the DPP had been advising or looking into what prosecution should be brought against the Murdoch organization, and suddenly the DPP leaves and is suddenly hired by Murdoch. He's not as aggressive or as overtly political in Britain as he is in the United States, because he doesn't have to be.
Well, but he's restrained by the BBC, and which is probably explains why he is obsessed about trying to bring down the BBC.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. So I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles from London, Philip Knightley, and filling us in on this unraveling scandal.
Good. A pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Philip Knightley, who was a special correspondent for the Sunday Times of London for 20 years. He was one of the leaders of its Inside investigative team. He twice was named Journalist of the Year. in the British Press Awards and won the Overseas Press Club of America Award for his first book on war correspondence, The First Casualty. He also wrote the autobiography, A Hack's Progress. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be joined in the studio by LA Times investigative reporter Bill Rempel. Dead one, red rum, political bedlam. Don't let the hype into your eyes and eardrum. Murdoch on Fox, not 18 with Barackas. And he hate Barack cause he marched with the marches.
I pledge allegiance to the fair and balanced truth. Not the biased truth, not the liar's truth, but the highest truth. I will not be deceived, nor will I believe in the propaganda. I will not.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is William C. Rempel, who spent 36 years as an investigative reporter and editor at the Los Angeles Times. His journalistic honors include an Overseas Press Club Award, a Gerald Loeb Award, and he was a finalist for the Goldsmith Prize for Investigative Journalism. His latest book, Just Ours, is At the Devil's Table, The Untold Story of the Insider Who Brought Down the Cali Cartel. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Rempel.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Ian.
And clearly, the Central and South America has been beset by drug cartels and the power, the enormous, extraordinary financial and political power that they wield. And your story is in large part about the grip, the malignant grip they had on the country of Colombia, and the extent to which how one man brought them down.
Well, that's right. It's about the story of George Salcedo, or Jorge, when he was in Colombia. He was one of the highest insiders to ever turn. He was chief of security for the cartel, for the boss of the bosses, Miguel Rodriguez. And from his vantage point, he was participating in that and seeing the degree of corruption. He passed payments on to police and the police and the justice system, the government, the ministers, prosecutors, businessmen, everyone was beholden to the Cali cartel. They dispensed money the way Halliburton would.
Well, one of the things that I find, there's two ironies in this story. And one is that success in many ways translates as failure, because what happens is if with the combination of your character that you profile and Plan Colombia, the billions of the U.S. poured in there and the resources, eventually they broke the back of the cartel and then they moved to Mexico.
Well, that's right.
And now they've taken over Colombia out of Guatemala and they're moving into Honduras and they've already suborned apparently the Venezuelan army and God knows where else.
And Mexico is just rife with violence. And it's right. It's an irony that the fall of the Cali cartel, which was a great success. In fact, it's probably the biggest success that the war on drugs can claim in 40 years. That bringing down Cali was an enormous success, and the result is Mexico. The remnants of the Cali cartel, the Colombian traffickers, ended up becoming wholesalers to the Mexican smuggling gangs. And that's the new reality. And so now there's a major problem in Mexico, and then as you say, in Guatemala and the other countries of Latin America, where the wealth is now being concentrated in smaller countries, where it probably has an even greater danger to suborn the governments and the institutions of those countries.
And the other irony, Bill Rempel, seems to me to be that so much of the violence is meted out against fellow cartel people.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's reached a point of hideousness. You know, particularly the Zetas in Mexico are brutal beyond the comprehension, and obviously, you understand why they're paranoid, because that's the strategy, isn't it? To find somebody on the inside to break it, and that
it's a corrosive fear that they all have. They don't know who the hell
is. That sort of violence has a chilling effect, yes. There is no better and more certain way to intimidate your employees or your partners than to risk having your beheaded literally or figuratively. And that does keep discipline quite effective.
Right, and your character is this. He's watching a guy being slowly strangled with a rope that's being twisted by a stick, and a guy runs by him with some mohawk haircut.
His mullet, yeah.
And saying, where's a knife?
I need a knife. Yeah.
And he's the disemboweler.
Yes.
That's his job.
Well, that's because in the Colombian cartel like to have their victims disappear. Mm-hmm. They weren't big on making these big violent statements the way Mexican gangs are or the way Pablo Escobar was. So their MO was you kill them, enforce the discipline, disembowel them, put them in the river, Cauca River, and they float away and are never seen again. So that's part of the process of making sure the body doesn't float too soon.
But this, of course, in the case of George or Jorge, who I take it you've spent a lot of time with this guy, and even though he's in witness protection.
He's in witness protection, and I could not spend a lot of time with him in person because I don't know where he is.
Right.
He did. Most of our interviews are on the phone. I met him the first time in a courthouse in Miami where he was making an appearance in federal court. And after that, when the book project, he wanted me to sit down with him. He wanted to do this, the first bit of interviewing in person for that. And he arranged on his terms, picked a city, said, go to that city, then tell me where you're staying, and I'll come to you. And so that's how we did it. And I went to the city, and he came to the city. And in the morning of the first he waited. I waited at my room until George came to the door. And it was the beginning of a 3-day session where we just worked 18-hour days telling stories. And but over time, I've done about 1,000 hours of telephone interviews. I don't know where he is. I can't go see him. He calls me. It's quite an unusual source relationship. I've never had one like it.
But his story is I mean, you obviously throughout these many, many hours, you've got an extraordinary picture of the
yes.
evolution of a guy. Because we always thought, and I suppose to some extent there was reason to think that the Cali cartel were the gentlemen as opposed to Escobar.
In fact, they prided themselves in being the gentlemen of Cali.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of their MOs. They were very careful to work on their reputation. They built police stations in Cali. They gave money to the law school. They held festivals, brought in salsa singers and performed for the city. They owned the local soccer team. Mm-hmm. It was very different. They paid people off, whereas Pablo Escobar killed them. It was a significant difference in style, and they were at war with each other.
Mm-hmm.
As a consequence, too.
Well, but hadn't Escobar killed Jorge's friend? Because his first job with the Cali cartel was to kill Escobar.
Yeah, well, just a quick thumbnail on George. He was a businessman, a 40-year-old engineer whose jobs were things like designing forklifts and oil refineries and things mm-hmm. like that. And he was but he also was he was in surveillance and intelligence in the Army Reserve. And so in that capacity, he'd met some British mercenaries who wanted to come over and help Colombia rid itself of the FARC and the other insurgents. But because he knew them, the Cali cartel found out about it and said, why don't you bring those guys over to help us kill Pablo? And Pablo was someone who, as you mentioned, he'd killed a schoolboy, a chum of George. He had become the Minister of Justice. He'd also set bombs in street corners.
Lara Bonilla was a friend of his, wasn't he?
He was. He and Rodrigo Lara shared a desk in kindergarten, literally.
Yeah.
So they were friends. But everybody in Colombia had lost friends to Pablo, it seemed. It was if Pablo targeted the elite of Colombian society and politics, assassinated presidential candidates and killed judges and police who investigated him. That was not the Cali way. That was Pablo's way. And so for George, it was a patriotic thing to come out and help someone dispose of Pablo.
Again, I'm speaking with William C. Rempel, who spent 36 years as an investigative reporter and editor at the Los Angeles Times. His latest book just out is At the Devil's Table, The Untold Story of the Insider Who Brought Down the Cali Cartel. But, of course, he soon became, well, I mentioned the story of the guy that was being strangled and then the disemboweling specialist shows up, but it's very dramatic how he gets out of there, and there's some quite surreal touches there with the DEA have zeroed in on the apartment where the cartel leaders
That's right. In fact,
George, in a vault, and then there's some weird little Napoleonic character that shows up.
Well, what happened was George had because he was one of about half a dozen people who knew where Miguel Rodriguez, the boss of the bosses, was holed up, and he led the DEA to that apartment. And when they hit the apartment, they hit it slowly, unfortunately, because they tried to do it that way. They were held up by events and uncooperative locals. But then once they got in, by that time Miguel was in what they call a coleta. It's like a panic room, a little room that you can't tell it's there by any outward sign. They knew eventually where he was in there, but it took hours to figure it out. They were drilling holes in the wall with drill bits, and they were sledgehammering and pounding. And
meanwhile, they broke up in a desk and found
they found a lot
of good information.
But they also were interrupted by friends of Miguel. The friends of the cartel got word to the a local prosecutor, who sent a man over and said, "Wait a minute! Look, came in a little fellow that they describe as Napoleon. Came in with a little portable typewriter and a case, set it up on the table in the dining room, and started to type up a complaint against the DEA for exceeding the authority of their warrant."
So this is the sort of surreal nature of it, but it also gives you a notion, I think, of how much the justice system had been
It was corrupt. And that doesn't mean everybody was.
Right.
But when it came time for George to try to get out of the cartel, he knew that he couldn't trust a single Colombian, not because they were all dishonest, but because next to every honest Colombian would be someone who wasn't.
Right.
He knew that there was corruption at every level, and it wouldn't, it just took one person. Like there were a couple of sources that the cartel had inside the elite anti-narcotics team. The pilot who flew General Serrano on raids got his flight training paid for by Gilberto Rodriguez, the other brother of the other godfather. So at all these levels, and they were personal, and they were family, and they were business, there were compromised people in every arena of government and institutions.
So, but he did also manage to get the bookkeeper out, didn't he? I mean, that was a valuable guy.
The accountant for the Cali cartel.
I mean, that's always in the movies. The bookkeeper.
It's always it's the butler and the accountant. The accountant knew everything. I mean, he encoded the entire financial empire of the Cali cartel, and had collected details and on discs and in paperwork and knew what every code meant, and he was the key to being able to bring down the financial empire that did exist, and to identify all the people that were on the payroll. Now, keep in mind that the cartel was paying monthly fees to police on the payroll of $20,000 for locals, $60,000 a month for the national.
But their take was $7 billion or something. So.
$7 billion a year at its peak. Yeah, so it was peanuts.
So just in the last minute here, that's just turning to the broader paradox of how the drug cartels have moved over from one country to the other and become a lot of the leaders of these countries recently met and said that they've got to end the war on drugs. What's the possibility of anything happening here? We've got a minute to go.
Well, I don't know the solution to it, except that the wealth is what is the problem. Whether you find a way to, if you legalize, does that take the wealth out of it? I don't know. But that's what it's going to take. The only way you're going to make a difference is to make sure that the wealth doesn't buy countries like it did in Colombia. Now, so far, Mexico doesn't seem to have that that the fight in the United States being going after the crime lords, the crime gangs, does make a difference.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. William Rempel again, 36-year veteran investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times. His latest book, At the Devil's Table, The Untold Story of the Insider Who Brought Down the Cali Cartel. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? We started out with Professor James Galbraith, who's one of the better economists, talking about this extraordinary showdown between the president and the Congress over this completely Republican-generated phony debt ceiling crisis, which, for reasons which I am totally unfathomable, the president has bought into. And, of course, in the president's press conference today, he did at least lay down a marker where if he will veto a bill unless it's for the big deal as opposed to stopgap measures, whether he can exercise and how he can exercise that leverage was this discussion. And of course, the Professor Galbraith, being an economist, kept saying, well, we're talking about politics, not economics. But the reality is that it's not about economics. The debt ceiling is a phony issue. After all, it is the Republicans who ran up the debt to the extent Bush was responsible for a third, and Bush Senior and Junior and Reagan combined are responsible for over a half. So we're really talking about what was on the table in these in terms of what Obama's prepared to cut, including some of what he calls the Democratic sacred cows. And there, Galbraith really went to town on the idea that that the president would even consider cutting Social Security and Medicare and all of these programs that are completely unnecessary and not called for. And the idea that he would be buffaloed into doing this in this phony crisis is really disgraceful. And then we went to London to talk with a veteran reporter, Philip Knightley, about this scandal of that is now being described as Rupert Murdoch's Watergate. And it turns out that Murdoch's minions were digging up dirt on the former British Prime Minister. And the real question is, will the British politicians now feel emboldened enough to stand up to Murdoch, who is the kingmaker over there? He can either make or break them. What was interesting, though, was that the divisions within the Murdoch family, apparently the young Chinese woman that he married is now running off having an affairs and taking her chunk of his fortune, and he's defending this horrible woman in Britain because she's kind of a surrogate daughter who's going to inherit or take care of his business after he's gone, presumably while the Chinese girl tries to grab what she can. Extraordinary to think that Murdoch, who owns Fox News over here, of course, could be in a Watergate situation, because it's pretty hard not to believe that he knew what was going on. That couldn't happen to a nicer guy, what can I say? Then finally, we talked with veteran Los Angeles Times investigative reporter Bill Rempel, who's written a book about the Cali Cartel, but we talked really about how the drug trade has infected all of Central and South America, and success in Colombia meant failure in Mexico because they just moved their operations to Mexico. And it's a fascinating tale about an inside guy who they got to break the cartel. But at the end of the day, the war on drugs is a total disaster, and it's destroying all of these countries, and it's fueled by our appetite for drugs here in the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producer, Spencer Downing, and Kim Nassiter, and Graham Fitzgibbon, our production intern. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.